This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Kentucky's Secretary of State says no to President Trump's election commission. The Commonwealth's governor and attorney general continue their running feud, and several new Kentucky laws go into effect. We'll discuss these and other recent developments in Kentucky politics. Later on the show, we'll look at the latest tri-state business news, including how Kroger is working to meet the challenges of a changing supermarket industry. Joining me first, our political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher, and Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan and James, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Allison Lundergan Grimes. She's refusing to send data to President Trump's newly formed election commission. And this commission is looking into claims of voter fraud in the 2016 election. Dan, why is she saying no? Why is she against this?
So she is actually joining, I think, 43 other states in saying no, or that they won't give the full amount of data. And one of the things that she expressed concern about was kind of giving support to a lie. So Trump has made these claims that there was massive voter fraud in the 2016 election, but there isn't much evidence that backs that up.
Yeah,
He's claiming
3 million or more votes were illegitimate votes.
Yeah, and he has said repeatedly that if you count those votes or discount those votes, he would have won the popular vote, because he didn't win the popular vote, but he did win the Electoral College. And that's obviously irked him since he took office. So, this is seen as a way that maybe he can validate himself in that perspective as well.
And Dan, that's why she's saying she objects to this. That's her main point she makes.
Yeah, basically, yeah. She thinks that by giving over this information, it'll lend kind of authority to that claim. But there are also other concerns that people have. Some people are worried about an invasion of privacy because they're asking for a lot of information. I mean, who you have voted for, your voting history, your part of your social security number, your date of birth, your political affiliation.
In some states are asking for driver's license numbers as well.
Yeah. There are other attorney generals secretary of states that are worried about voter suppression, that if the Trump administration has all of this data, they might try to suppress some voters that they don't really want to be going to the polls.
Now, of course, the White House has come back and said, oh, no, only 14 states have declined to give us information. So it becomes semantics. Actually, and you were right in that it's about 44 plus D.C. have refused some level of information. So they'll give them what's publicly available, who's on the voter or who's on the voter list and what party they're registered under, which is publicly available in most states, but nothing else. So that they're saying, oh, they're cooperating. Well, they're not giving them everything they want. This committee, like you said, this commission is asking for a much deeper level of confidential information that has a lot of privacy advocates concerned as well.
Dan, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's exactly right. And there's also, I mean, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that the letter did kind of say it listed information that they wanted, but it said publicly available information that they wanted. So I can kind of see how the Trump administration is kind of walking that line of saying that they complied or they didn't comply, because the request in and of itself was kind of strange. And so I can see where they're coming from there.
One thing on, and a lot of people in Kentucky have called, have accused Grimes of just doing this for partisan reasons. She's a Democrat. She's only one of two Democrats that hold a statewide office. What backs her up is that several other Republican secretaries of state elsewhere have refused.
Refusals have been bipartisan.
Yeah, Houston in Ohio has also pushed back on this. He's the secretary of state here in Ohio, and he's pushed back on this as well. So, you know, a lot of people said it's a political stunt and by her, and some people are saying it's a political stunt by the White House and the Trump administration. But the pushback has been pretty broadly bipartisan across the country.
Now, Secretary of State Grimes was on the Sunday talk shows, and she kept saying, not on my watch. She repeated this several times. So is she setting herself up for a run for a higher office, perhaps?
Well, she already ran against Mitch McConnell and lost pretty badly for the U.S. Senate position. She has been touted, and then she was being strongly recruited in the last governor's race. But she was just coming off just very recently that loss to McConnell, so she was still licking her wounds over that. And she knew she'd have a pretty easy reelection to the Secretary of State's position. She's just hold bar there, and she's one of only two Democrats to win in what was a very red election, a very Republican election last time around statewide. The state legislature turned Republican for the first time in decades or ever. So now both houses plus the Republicans, plus the governor's office are all Republicans. So, I think, yes, this is a way for her to become more visible in the Democratic Party, not only here, but nationally. And I would not be surprised either for her or Beshear, the attorney general, to make a run at Bevin in the next governor's election.
What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
Yep. So she is definitely out in the 6th congressional district, which is the congressional district where she's from. She's not running in that race, so she's not looking at Congress immediately. But there is speculation that she's looking at the gubernatorial race. Like, her statement about whether or not she was going to run for that congressional race said that she's not looking at any races in 2018, which, of course, leaves the door open for that run in 2019 for governor. So I think that if I were putting my money anywhere, I would say that's the race that she's looking at to get into. But again, she hasn't made any public statement saying, yes, I'm definitely running for governor.
Dan, talk about the latest in this political feud between Governor Matt Bevin and Attorney General Andy Beshear. It's been kind of an ongoing thing, and it ebbs and flows, but it seems to be flaring up again. So what's the latest iteration on this?
Yeah, so, I mean, the Attorney General has obviously sued the governor several times, and he added another one, I guess, a week or two ago. So he's suing the governor over the restructuring of the education boards, if I recall correctly. And so last week, there was Beshear's making an announcement about how he was going to try and sue some drug companies over the opioid epidemic. And right before Beshear's press conference, Senate President Robert Stivers did a press conference of his own where he said that he thinks that a case with Purdue Pharma was settled because there could have been a potential conflict of interest with Andy Beshear when Andy Beshear took office. And so he's alleging that Jack Conway, who lost the race to Governor Bevin, settled that for a lower amount than he should have gotten because there was a potential conflict of interest. And so then that set Beshear off, and Beshear attacked the Stivers' wife, and so there was all this drama swirling around. And then that day, Beshear sent a letter to Governor Bevin saying that he would like to cooperate with Bevin and send out an email to all state employees about scam alerts, saying, hey, scam alerts are a thing. You need to protect senior citizens against scams, and we should cooperate on this, and we should send out an email together. However, Bevin got notice of this email or this letter to him through the press. So Bevin took it as a publicity stunt and replied with a letter of his own where he said that he gave this list of demands of things that Beshear needed to do before Bevin would cooperate with him. And one of them was state that Beshear wasn't sexist because there's this ongoing sexual discrimination trial in the attorney general's office. And he had to give information up about the Purdue Pharma case and whether or not there were potential conflicts of interest. So, yeah, Bevin basically just responded with this list of demands of all the scandals that he sees in Beshear's office to try and point those out.
You know, it's funny.
Kind of like sparring back and forth.
You know, what's funny about this is they're talking about these letters going back and forth. Their offices are literally like 100 yards apart. Or if you've ever been in the Kentucky State Capitol, they're on the same floor. They're on the bottom floor, the executive branch. It's one of the only capitals in the country where the legislation, the legislature, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch all have offices in the same building. So the executive branch is on the bottom floor, and literally less than 200 yards, the two offices are less than 200 yards away. So it's funny. This just strikes me as funny that they're throwing these letters back and forth and they can't walk across the hall.
Dan, I think you had described them as that they had become pen pals is what happened.
In a way, yeah, letters, I guess it's 2017 and they're still sending letters back and forth. They're trying to help each other out or trying to help the Postal Service out. I don't know. I think they're walking and delivering these letters. It's just kind of like, I mean, when you explain it, it's complex and it just kind of seems a little silly that this is the way that they're sparring out this little political feud.
Any signs that this is ever going to end?
I don't think so, because there is a little personal animus between Bevin and the Bashir family, because, I mean, it goes back to when Bevin took over. They took Bashir's wife's name off of one of the visitor center, and that got a little bit of play, and it just seemed kind of petty at the time. So, you know, obviously Andy Bashir's dad is Steve Bashir, who was the previous governor, and the previous governor actually has been involved in the national debate about health care. Kentucky's been seen as this bastion of health care, of Obamacare. So Bevin wants to get rid of all that. And he's trying to uphold his dad's legacy. Plus, he's installed himself as Bevin's watchdog, because Bevin wants to change all this stuff about state government. But Bashir has installed himself. I don't see this going away anytime soon.
Yeah, and around the Capitol, some members of the press corps have said that, in a way, Bevin, he might be one of those guys who plays best angry, and he needs that kind of political foil, that political rival. And Bashir's kind of served as that foil for him in this time. I mean, they've been going head to head since both of them took office. And so maybe that helps Bevin out in terms of how he accomplishes some of his missions.
Now, Dan, Bashir, meantime, this gets kind of overshadowed by this dispute, but Bashir, meantime, says he's planning to go ahead and file lawsuits against the drug makers. So can you tell us a little bit more about what's involved with that?
Yeah, my colleague covered that story a little bit more than I did, so I just kind of have a cursory impression of it. But basically, there's kind of this national movement to go after the drug companies for their role in the opioid epidemic, because they were really pushing some of these opioid pills. I mean, pain became the fifth vital sign, and they were trying to get their product out, I guess, to treat pain. And so there's been pushback, and so Bashir's kind of joining in that pushback and saying, hey, we need to hold these drug companies responsible for the role that they played, and now he's going to start filing suit against them. That's kind of, there was already one of these suits in Kentucky against Purdue Pharma that was started by Greg Stumbo when he was attorney general, and then carried on by Conway, and that was settled for $24 million, which Republicans are now saying that wasn't enough money. That the state should have gotten way more than that. And so now the state's going to launch a series of other lawsuits against some of these drug companies to try and hold them accountable.
And the thing that has happened since some of these other cases were settled, 5-10 years ago, is that it's clearly come out that some of what these drugs were sold as back in the 2000s and 90s and 2000s, there is actually – literature put out that these were non-addictive. The drug companies were advertising this as being non-addictive and linking to these very nebulous studies that say that. So now it comes full circle that they are addictive. They're incredibly addictive, and that's actually led to the heroin and fentanyl epidemic that we're dealing with. So, not just Bashir, but other states certainly have a lot more to go on when it comes to this.
Dan, is Bashir's office going to handle this litigation on its own, or they're going to bring in somebody to help with this?
From what I understand, they were going to bring in some help, but I'm not 100% sure on that and could very well be wrong. I can look it up for you, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, let's kind of move forward a little bit on this, because we had 130 new laws that were signed in by Governor Bevin. One of those has to deal with the opioid crisis. It's a 3-day wait on opioid prescriptions. So what's the thinking behind that, Dan?
So basically what they want to do, the CDC came out with these recommendations a year or two ago that says that for acute pain, that's like stuff like your wisdom teeth surgery, you only need like 3 to 7 days of opioids if they're prescribed at all. And so now states are kind of taking those guidelines and they're putting them into law. So in places like Massachusetts, they have a 7-day period. So you're only going to get 7 days worth of opioids if you go and get your wisdom teeth taken out. That's the maximum that you can get. And so then in Kentucky, they probably have one of the strongest limits. It's only 3 days. So if you get your wisdom teeth taken out, you can only get 3 days worth of pain pills. Of course, there are exceptions to that. So it's between the doctor and the patient. And so if the doctor feels like there's a need for more than 3 days of pills, they can still prescribe that. But in general, it's trying to create this standard where doctors are being more conservative about how many pills they give to these patients. Because oftentimes with this opioid epidemic, we would see people having pain pills and then they would have leftover pills and they'd start getting addicted to those leftover pills, or somebody would sell off those leftover pills, and it was just kind of contributing to this wider crisis as a whole. And so they're trying to address that, and they're trying to limit how much patients get so that they don't get addicted.
Yeah, I think one of the concerns that medical experts had about this 3-day limit was that, hey, it'll help prevent future addictions, but it's not doing much to help those who are already addicted.
Yeah, exactly. And that is a kind of a flaw in it. And this bill as a whole, I mean, it was mostly trying to address, future addictions, but also it has stricter standards for fentanyl punishments. So it defined fentanyl legally so that cops can now use that language to prosecute fentanyl, people who are dealing fentanyl. Fentanyl is basically it's way stronger than your standard opioid, and drug users or drug dealers will mix it with heroin to create like this really, really high intensity drug, and a lot of people overdose from it. And so we've seen a lot of overdoses in the region. And so they're trying to cut back on the fentanyl dealing.
Yeah, didn't Kentucky have a record? Wasn't last year a record for drug overdoses in Kentucky?
I think it might have been, and we saw a rash of them. I mean, they started in Huntington, West Virginia, and then you could kind of see them spread over the state as this whatever batch of heroin that had fentanyl laced in started getting out there. And it's really dangerous. I mean, there's stories about dogs that are drug-sniffing dogs that sniff a little bit of the fentanyl and then they overdose. So it's really high intensity.
Not only
so
that, but
they're trying to cut back on that too.
We were talking about last year. Okay, I mean, we're on pace to break that last year's record already this year, both in Ohio and Kentucky. So, I mean, it's still growing.
Yeah.
It's still growing. So, yeah. I think one of the other things that the 3-day limit was aimed at was there are still out there these pain pill mills, where, you know, doctors, I use quotation marks here, will just do nothing but fill out prescriptions. They've cracked down on that quite a bit, but this will make it much more difficult for somebody just to go in and get a script for a month's worth or a week's worth of OxyContin or whatever.
Dan, does this bill take effect right away, or is there still something else they have to do to?
So there's a little bit of, so like the new definition, the legal definition, that takes effect right away. But in terms of the medical standards, those need to go through a whole process and be approved by the medical board. So that will go into effect in, I guess, a few months. But for the in terms of the legal definitions, yeah. And I wanted to mention, so I did talk to a doctor who said, yeah, this is stopping it up front, but they stopping people from getting addicted, but they do need to do more for recovery. And there was a companion bill with this that was in the House, but it failed to pass the Senate. And so it's only this bill that became law. The other one, in the last day, it got passed over because they were rushing through a flurry of bills, and that one never happened.
So what were some of the other key laws that went into effect?
So charter schools, that went into effect. So they can start, I guess, the process of recruiting charter schools to the state. That was a really big battle in the legislature. There's some of these religious freedom in schools bills that went into effect. So you can do like there's a Bible literacy course that might be added to the curriculum. And then there's that bill for the bill that caused California to create the travel ban, where it allows more religious freedom in schools. Gay rights groups were concerned that it would create discrimination against gay students because under the guise of religious freedom. So that one goes into effect, and that's why California banned travel here.
Circling back on the charter schools, you know, I read that legislation because I follow charter schools in Ohio quite a bit. They still need to set up a whole infrastructure. I mean, basically, the bill didn't, mm-hmm. the new law basically does nothing but authorize the concept. They still have to put a lot of infrastructure around. Are they going to do sponsors? Are they going to have companies come in? Who can have a charter school? They still have to make all those kinds of definitions as well.
And Dan,
yeah, it's going to be a few years before we see charter schools. Right. It's just that process can now begin.
And then there's the bill that was known as Blue Lives Matter. That also was signed into law, wasn't
yes.
it? Yeah.
Yeah, that one, which that doesn't really do a ton. I mean, there are already stricter standards if you go after a cop. And the hate crime law in Kentucky does not cover homicides. So it won't really do as much with that. It's more of sentencing. It's an extra tool for judges to use during sentencing. So I don't know how much we'll see that used. And the other law that I neglected to mention was medical review panels. There's a lawsuit against that that was just filed about that. But medical review panels are going into effect, and that was part of the tort reform that the conservatives really wanted to see passed during this session.
What will those panels do exactly? What's the purpose of them?
Basically, it'll make it a little bit harder for you to sue your doctor for malpractice. So if you want to see your doctor for malpractice, there's a panel that has to determine whether or not this committee of doctors that will determine whether or not it's a legitimate lawsuit before it even goes to court. So it's just kind of putting in an extra protection for doctors.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher. And we'll continue our weekly news review. Next up, we'll talk with James Pilcher about his story on Ohio's rural jobs tax credit. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. And joining us this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. James, was going to be part of Ohio's new budget, but the rural jobs tax credit didn't survive Governor Kasich's veto.
But it came close. It came very close. This is like the fourth time they've tried it.
But you think this is going to be back?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely going to be back. So just a little bit of background. these have been called CAPCOs. They've been called rural jobs credits. They've been called new market tax credits. But they're popping up in states all over the country. And basically what it does is it allows a private company to come in and either loan or invest in local businesses or whatever, and they get a tax credit in return. So it's kind of seen as a way to get private capital into areas where you need it the most, i.e. in this case, it would have been half of it had to go to a quote-unquote rural area or a high-growth industry, which pretty much covers almost everything in Ohio. But what's happened in other states is there's been a lot of oversight on it, and the people who make the investment are able to walk away without a lot of repercussion, and they still keep the tax credit even if the business has failed. So it's got a mixed history. These programs have a mixed history, and there's a group of companies, about four or five companies, who have really pushed this legislation and lobbied for this legislation in states all over the country. Three of them have been leading the pack, and three of them have been involved in the past, and two were involved in this last one. They finally got it. Last year it barely missed being passed as a separate bill, so they stuck it in the budget this time. At the last minute, Governor John Kasich vetoed it. I heard they just came up a few votes shy of overriding the veto, so you can guarantee it would come back next year. This particular one would have been $60 million in tax credits spread out over 4 years. the bill's advocates, including the state rep from Middletown, or Butler County, says that they put more safeguards than other states would have been. The tax credits wouldn't have started for 2 years. They would have been spread out over 4 years, so the company would have to make its investments up front and then get the tax credits later. And there are advocates for these kinds of things because, you know, there are places where it is hard for you to get a loan or something because of it being rural. There's not a lot of capital out there or whatever. But like I said, in other states, there have been major issues with things falling apart.
So in vetoing it, I guess Governor Kasich was looking at that control issue. Was that his main concern?
I don't know what his rationale was. I think maybe it was more of I've been told through sources that it was more of a fear of replicating the sins of the past in other states.
So if it is going to pass, what do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think that they need a few more votes in the legislature. There are still people in—
What would win them over, though? What would give them the reassurance that this is going to work right?
I think more of a clawback. I mean, there are some clawbacks if they don't meet the job standards, but I think they need to have more teeth in it. And I think they need to give I think that the advocates or the people who are asking for more control would give the state agency more oversight. Because right now, the state has no say in what the companies can invest in. So the companies have complete control over who they invest in. So I think the state would want to, I think those who are looking for more control would want the state to have a little bit more say in that.
You also looked into a Major League Baseball umpire who is suing the league and the league's commissioner. Well, what's this all about?
Yeah, the suit was filed late Monday, the day before the 4th of July, by a veteran umpire, 25-year umpire by the name of Angel Hernandez, who's from Cuba. He was born in Cuba, and he came here when he was like 1 year old. His father immigrated back in the 60s. So basically, he is saying that he has been passed over several times for becoming a permanent crew chief, and he is alleging it's because of race or ethnicity. And he points to the fact that baseball has only had one permanent minority crew chief in the history of the game. I mean, we're going back to the whole history of the game. There's only 10 umpires who are minorities, according to my review of the roster.
10 out of how many?
There's 92 on the roster, okay. And there's really like 78 or 80 work full time. The others are kind of come in and go. And they call up people from the AAA and things like that. So they come and go. But there's 10 veteran minority umpires on the roster. In addition, there's only been one minority umpire to work the World Series in the last since 2010, 2011. And a lot of this stems from the fact, even says in the lawsuit, he got into a run-in with a former New York Yankees manager, Joe Torre, when Torre was managing back in 2001. Well, now Torre is running baseball. Torre oversees the umpires.
He's a chief baseball officer.
He runs baseball, and he oversees all the umpires. So he is saying, since Torre took over, all of my reviews have gone down. I've not gotten any assignments. So there's obviously a personal issue there. And what's going to be interesting is, are they going to be able to separate the issue of the numbers that I just described from the actual individual Angel Hernandez, who, let's just say, has a colorful past as an umpire? I mean, he's known for being called out by a football player at the seventh inning stretch at Wrigley Field. He's known for what turned out to be a blown call of a home run that would have won the game for the Oakland A's. And the replay, he didn't overturn the replay. Well, there's a lot of reasons behind that. But there are several throughout the years, and he shows up on worst umpire lists all over the internet. Now, some of that is subjective.
But he's claiming that his reviews were good up until that
and
spat
even
with
after
Torre.
That, they were good. And that his accuracy rate, I mean, MLB tracks pitch by pitch how accurate an umpire is. And he says his accuracy rate was close to 97% on balls and strikes last year. So, you know, this is going to be fascinating to watch. But I think baseball has an image problem on its hands right now. Ironically, they named Hernandez to the All-Star game as an umpire.
James, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
This afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. Coming up, we'll review business news of the week, including a look at how Kroger is handling the shifting supermarket industry. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. And joining me right now, Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge and WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan and Alex, good to see both of you this afternoon.
Nice to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, online retailing giant Amazon announced it's going to buy Whole Foods. And the big question is, how's this going to affect Kroger? What's at stake for Kroger in all this, Alex?
Well, it's the Death Star, potentially.
Is it really that extreme?
They're taking it very seriously. But no. They're not going to – but they're taking it very seriously. People are acting like it's the Death Star. When that was announced, the day of, retail stocks plummeted like 4 to 6%. I think 9% for one of them was.
Yeah, I know Kroger lost 30% of its value in 2 days.
Right,
yeah.
and Kroger is year to date, it's down about that right now. So most of this has just come recently. It's down about 32%.
Hmm. Yeah, part of that was also they had a disappointing outlook announced, ironically. The day the Amazon thing was announced came the day after they lowered their outlook. And the reason they lowered their profit outlook was they basically had decided to reallocate more than $200 million to reinvest back into the business, to be proactive against stuff like, oh, I don't know, maybe Amazon will get more serious about groceries or something. And then the next day, this happens, and the stock goes down even more.
Is it even clear, Alex, that Amazon wants to get into a grocery war?
Well, you know, that's what everybody's sort of on edge watching. Here's the thing. Okay. If Amazon sells you groceries in Cincinnati right now through their Prime Now service, which is really interesting, they've got like 4,000 or so items, 41, I think, actual grocery and gourmet food items that you can buy. And that sounds like a lot until you start really looking at the categories that you can actually get. If you just look at produce items offered by Amazon's Prime Now right now, they have 12 fruit items. So if you want bananas, regular or organic, you're set. If you want, Fuji apples, regular or organic, you're set as long as you buy it in a 3-pound bag. But if you want pears, plums, peaches, pomegranates, you're out of luck. Can't get them from Amazon Prime right now. So basically, if you look at the total food items that are available, the 4,100, a typical Kroger branded convenience store has about 3,500. So it's a different business model right now. Right now, it's a different business model. It's great convenience, more limited selection. Now, they're obviously buying the supermarket chain. The question everybody wants to know is, well, how much Whole Foods SKUs are going to wind up on Amazon Prime Now or other services? And we don't know that.
Well, in terms of size, I think Whole Foods is, what, only 400 stores nationwide?
Yeah, it's a 400. The whole chain's like 460, but they have presence in the UK or stuff like that. But here's the thing. Amazon wants to play, obviously, is a very digital-centric retailer, and they're going to emphasize that. So there's a lot of talk about how they're going to use, how they're going to leverage the real estate to bolster deliveries. Basically, they'll use Whole Foods stores. The speculation is they'll use Whole Foods stores as sort of like hubs to further supply their deliveries.
Dan, what's your thought? Do you think they want to get into a grocery war with anybody?
Well, Amazon?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think it's part of their they're trying to broaden the universe of products that they can supply to people by delivering them. And they're working on expanding their delivery capacity to get things to you more quickly. I think it'll be 5 or 10 years before it has a real impact on the grocery industry. It's less than, isn't it less than 5% of groceries sold online now?
Yeah.
People think that could reach 20% someday, but that leaves 80% of the business for a company like Kroger to compete in. And let's not forget that Kroger's kind of been here before fighting against the Death Star. This is the kind of language that people used about Walmart.
Yeah, when, talk about that smart.
You know, Walmart.
You actually wrote an article about that whole.
Yeah, they started expanding into the superstore concept and really expanding their grocery business.
That was what, 2001 or so, 2002?
That's when it started. 2004 is when it sort of became an urgent concern for shareholders. And, you know, Kroger has done pretty well against Walmart, not only by beating Walmart head-to-head in markets where they compete, but also by taking business away from weaker and smaller grocery operators. So there's plenty of room for Kroger to compete here. And one thing that's happening with Kroger that's kind of interesting, too, is that they're going more head-to-head against restaurants now with prepared food items. So they now see their market as a $1.5 trillion market, which includes not only groceries, but meals ready to eat, you know, for food that you can pick up at the grocery store on your way home, as opposed to going to a restaurant. So there's plenty of room, I think, for Kroger to grow in this environment, no matter what Amazon does for the next 5 years. And, you know, if someday we all have chips in our heads and we can think that we'd like a cold beer, and Alexa version 21.1 diagnoses that information and sends a drone to our back porch with a six-pack of Rheingeist Truth.
Right.
Maybe that's a thing that will cause Kroger to go out of business. But until that point arrives, I don't think Kroger needs to be that
Kroger
worried.
Kroger is a very savvy competitor. Just a little more color.
How many
color.
Stores do they have nationwide?
About 2,500.
2,800 almost. Okay. Just a little shy of that.
And then they've started delving into the digital world as well, so they've got their online presence.
Here's the thing. What they're doing is the way they – a little more color on what Dan just said. In 2003, what Kroger did, when everybody is like going, oh, my God, the Death Star is here and it's called Walmart and we're all going to die – is the folks at Kroger very savvily sort of saw what other people were doing, and they were basically all committing suicide. So the Albertsons, the Super Values, Kmart very famously. You know, when I first got here to Cincinnati, one of my first assignments was to go to Kmart in Delhi and say, hey – so they're shutting this down because they totally blew it with Kmart very famously said, you know what, we're going to take on Walmart, like around 2001 or so. And they went out of business. They filed Chapter 11 and they whacked like a third of their stores because it was such a disaster. Basically, they spent all this money advertising about how they were going to undercut Walmart's prices. And Walmart took one look at this and said, okay. Well, we're going to lower our prices even deeper. Have fun with that one, Kmart. And they got their head handed
to them. Yeah.
What Kroger did, though, which was way smarter, is they said, okay, we got to get more competitive on price, but we're not going to be stupid about this. We're not going to try to out Walmart at its game, which is what everybody else is trying to do. And you had a lot of supermarkets just dumbly trying to do that, and it didn't work out. What they did was they lowered their prices enough to not be prohibitively expensive. And you can actually quantify this. You can look at this by looking at their financials through the years. Their gross margins are going down from about 28%, which is gross margin is a very initial form of profitability. There's other forms of profitability. I won't get into all that, but it shows up in their financials. They're lowering prices for several years. They get gross profit margins down into it's about like 20% now. And that's before you start paying off the lawyers and the light bills and the employees. So it's a very initial form of profitability. But at any rate, they neutralized the price enough so that shoppers are like starting to look at other things like, well, you know, is it fun to shop at Walmart, first of all? And, you know, do they have the variety of product that I want? And can I get in and out of the store quickly? And so other variables, other aspects in Kroger's offerings suddenly became much more relevant.
How much is food food deflation? How much is that still an issue for Kroger?
It's starting to not become an issue because we're, you know, 4 quarters in now to the deflation.
It's starting to lap, basically.
Yeah. So the prices are going to be on a quarter to quarter basis, not going to be that severe. But what's starting to happen is that there's increased competition, you know, from operators like Aldi and Lidl, both expanding in the U.S.
And also Walmart. And we're starting to see a price war, basically.
Yeah, between Walmart and Amazon and the new European invaders. So
didn't they recently sue Lidl?
They did for trademark infringement, yeah, because Lidl has a brand called Preferred Selection, and Kroger has a brand called Private Selection. And the argument is that they're too similar.
Sorry, Dan, I sidetracked you there. Go ahead, though.
Well, you know, on the price issue, Kroger is, you know, responding to this price competition. Alex mentioned the $200 million in new investment that they're making in that category. But what – and to add to something Alex also said, what Kroger does with price is much more sophisticated, I think, than they get credit for. They offer unique price promotions based on your buying patterns. And so they'll send out 6 million offers, you know, in a quarter where your price is different from anybody else's price. And I think that has helped them improve in terms of customer loyalty. I think that's something Amazon is also good at, figuring out what you want to buy and how to price it so that you will actually pull the trigger. But Kroger's no slouch in that department either. And the competition between Amazon and Walmart and Kroger, I think, is interesting because I think Walmart and Amazon are very similar in that they're logistic plays. Walmart got its prices low because they did logistics better than any grocery store could. Amazon is, you know, the king of logistics. They know how to move goods from one place to another cheaply. And that, I think, at this point is their main advantage. What will be interesting to see is whether they can actually operate a grocery store and whether people will drive past two Kroger stores to go to a Whole Foods supermarket, and whether or not they can use their skills at determining what people want to buy, whether they can use that effectively against Kroger's, you know, customer loyalty programs.
Now, Kroger's rolled out this trademarked phrase, feed the human spirit. What's that about?
They introduced that at the annual meeting, and I'm not sure if it's, you know, going to be sort of an internal message that they're using to promote the good work that they can do in a grocery store every day, or if this is going to be part of a, you know, an ongoing, you know, advertising campaign where they try to differentiate themselves against companies like Walmart and Amazon. I wouldn't be surprised to see it roll out as an ad campaign and Kroger trying to differentiate itself from its competitors. Because, you know, one thing they believe is that grocery shopping is a social endeavor. People like to talk about food. They like to see and touch and taste the food before they buy it. And if they can sell Kroger as a sort of a social interaction as opposed to just a piece of commerce, that gives them a competitive edge against somebody who just wants to sell you something cheap and get it to your door quickly.
Have you been able to gauge shareholder reaction to that new trademarked phrase?
No, none of the shareholders actually commented on it. And I was surprised that no shareholder mentioned Amazon during the entire meeting.
That was fascinating.
So on both things, they were quiet on the new trademark phrase and on Amazon.
Yeah. The only shareholder comment about a rival store was about Wegmans. Why can't you be more like Wegmans?
Yeah.
which is not bad advice.
That was fascinating. But that actually gets to the point of grocery shopping as sort of an experiential thing. Think wine tastings, cheese sampling, and all that stuff. So, and Kroger does plenty a lot of that. It's just a question of how well you do it. And Wegmans is renowned for pioneering that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Alex, speaking of grocery stores, you wrote about how the Clifton Market Co-op is doing after being in operation for 6 months. How is it doing?
Well, it's off to a bumpy start. The details are a little sketchy. Basically, they wanted to operate like a sort of one unit type of Whole Foods or like a nicer type of Kroger, and they're sort of they're just having some very severe grocery growing pains, basically.
Okay, so you think
how they're phrasing
growing,
it.
Okay, growing
they're
pains.
Averaging about $120,000.
They had projected $250 something?
And it was about $250. So they're below 50% below target. Also, they've said that they have average about 6,000 shoppers a week. So that comes to an average basket of $20 per visit, which is kind of low. What they're trying to do is they're assessing, how it's coming along. And there's a reason, folks like Kroger or somebody else didn't come jump in and operate this store when people were shopping for a potential outside operator. And then they also have the Kroger just expanded its old Coryville store. I mean, supersized it and made it a very sort of experiential sort of destination. The new downtown Kroger is going to borrow heavily from some of the aspects that they have placed there. There's a bar in the Coryville Kroger. I mean, right off of a college campus. I mean, that's a pretty good idea. So basically, Clifton Market has this a mile and a half away when they're trying to get some college kids in there. And it's a little more competitive than they expected. And there have been some complaints about prices of the actual goods at the Clifton Market. And they're looking at that. So, I mean, if you're
But you see this as just growing pains at this point.
Well, I can't predict success or failure. I'm saying that there's some very serious navel gazing that's going on right now.
Some contemplation and some readjusting.
Well, the community members, wanted to maintain this market, and it's proved to be more difficult than they expected. And they're trying to figure out how to make it a success,
how to make it a sustainable success. Dan, I wanted to ask you too, as we close out the show, the Cincinnati inked a deal for the $94 million Skyhouse project on the riverfront.
Yes.
So what's that project about? What is it?
It's about the same.
Huge.
Yeah, it's 300 units, roughly, apartment units. And from what they were telling me was that the units are going to be better suited to apartment sharing. So if you have a two-bedroom unit, they're going to price them such that, you can get two people who are, cohabitating to pay the, separate rent. And I think they'll sort of mine a different part of the market than the millennials and empty nesters that are common downtown. But it'll be just like the rest of the downtown market right now, where apartments are renting for up to $2,000 for a single bedroom unit, 250 cents per square foot, and it's sort of more of the same, only with better views.
And what was the deal the city signed this week? that city council approved this week.
On what the terms of the deal were?
Oh, it was a tax credit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a tax credit for the property. It's kind of they called it a precedent setting deal because it's not a direct city contribution to the project, and yet it has a clawback agreement that allows the city to recover money if the project does better than expected and is sold.
Yep. Alex and Dan, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Enquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge and WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk.